This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. God, family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're in the ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it, fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light, sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dead camp. Shotgun toter, Republican voter. Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA. Cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got.
Oh yeah, welcome to Trappin' Radio. This is your host, Clint Locklear. I had a great weekend, as you could tell from our when I was down at Chip's and with Tim Meat Trapper. I mean, that was a blast. There's a lot going on. This is probably going to be the most schizophrenic show you've ever heard in your life. I don't know if it's going to go way over or not. I'm going to try to run through all this. I started preparing for the show, and it just kind of like just different things that wanted to say and needed to say and everything else like that. First off, I have got to give a big applause to Ryan Schaefer from Louisiana. Now, he's got some shows on here you need to listen to, and you can go back and find them. And he's got an Instagram account. Guys, you need to follow Ryan on his Instagram account. You want to see what someone that lives an outdoorsman life looks like? Man, that is it. I mean, he's rocking when it comes to that. Cindy's like, what does he ever do besides hunt and gather food and cook crazy looking Cajun food? I mean, and it's just amazing what he does. But the other day, he posted on his Instagram, and I'm going to say this wrong, Etefete, which is I know wrong. But when me and Cindy were down, I was trapping in Louisiana many, many, many moons ago. And we stayed with a Louisiana family at Easter, and they had that. And that's the first time we've ever had it, and it was awesome. And Cindy just commented on his post. And the next thing we know, we get crawfish and a deboned chicken with crawfish stuffing in it that he sent up here. So last night, that's what we had. And we had the crawfish etefete. And awesome. So, dude, I appreciate that more than you can ever know, because it's exactly what we needed at the time. Cindy and me, and just like everybody else, it's like every school county that touches me is out. Everybody's sick. I mean, it's nasty out here. I mean, everybody seems to be sick. And Cindy got it really bad. She got it before I did. I had fuzzy head, still have it kind of. And that's not a medical term, but most of you know what that is. You just kind of like don't want to do anything. Everything seems like it's a big task, and you don't think very clearly. And when she started getting a sore throat, and I mean, it was pitiful. I mean, it was pitiful what she went through. She went to the doctor, and they tested her for strep. It wasn't strep, so I did a little bit of research, found out that strep is bacterial and the other things are viral. There's not really a lot that a doctor can give you for what she had, because it's an antibiotic, won't help anything but bacteria, basically. So I jumped and I go through all my herbal books, and I come up with something that I promise you, I think it'll help you, because I'm pretty sure it helped me. I still had the fuzzy head. I was fighting this thing, but I never got to the shape Cindy did with she couldn't hardly breathe with her throat. And snot running everywhere, and I mean, she just felt way miserable. So once she got to that state, we got the thing back from the strep. I went into research mode, found out it was viral, so I started looking up things that are antiviral, and I kept coming across this syrup that herbalists give people when they have a viral flu type symptoms. Now, let me warn you, if you do not have hair, and you take this, you will when you get done with it in a week. And if you have hair, you may be bald at the end of the week. Cindy just calls it vile. Not like the little glass tube, but so nasty it's vile. That's just what she calls it. Now, what this stuff is, it's real honey, not the stuff you get at Walmart. You need to find somewhere it gets real honey. And then, because that's antiviral, and you chop up the same amount of raw garlic cloves, and you heat them on a stove, and you squeeze in a bunch of lemons, and you just do this mixture up, and you put it in a jar, and you take a spoonful of it every hour. So basically what you're doing is you're overloading your body with antiviral properties, and it really helped me, and it got her from being the sickness she was. It really cut her time down. So just something to think about, guys. You know, we always say about taking your own income in your own hands, maybe a little bit of your health too. I'm not saying it'll work for you. It definitely seemed to help us, but it is butt nasty to eat that raw garlic like that. So be warned if you make some of that up. Now, I got tickled. This is why this is going to be such a schizophrenic show. I have probably one of the only AOL emails left in America, just because it's convenient. And it's just what everybody has, and instead of trying to get everybody to come up with a new email for me, I just kept it. Now, when you get on all these pages, well, no matter who you have, just every day, just take a minute to look at the news they put up there. Look at the wording of it. It is amazing to me. And this is what I'm going to read off to you are the top news on AOL just today. First, experts have alarming warning about Trump's feud, and they're talking about with Nordstrom over not having his wife clothes anymore. And then the next sentence is extraordinarily and depressing behavior. Meghan McCain slams Trump for the comments that he made about McCain. Conway apologizes to Trump office after Ivanka comments. Crowd shuts down chairman, which is was a Republican in Utah, in ruckus town meeting. White House investing leaks from Trump's calls. They're trying to get to the bottom of. Apparently, they've had some people that work in the tech department of the White House that just happened to be Muslim, and no one ever thought that would be an issue when they're not looking into what they're actually doing. And they've been recording phone calls, they think, and getting in all the emails and stuff from the congressmen and senators and Trump. And now they're actually thinking this is the leak with the emails from the DNC, which is very uncomfortable for the DNC because they built this whole mantra up because Russia is trying to change the election and stole it from Hillary. Okay. Senate confirms health secretary. That's the only positive one so far. Iran chants death to America. The only picture they showed was all these Iranians jumping up and down holding Trump signs. So Trump is the reason that Iranian hates America, even though they were still screaming that same thing when Obama was in. Trump reverses stance to back China policy. So obviously Trump has been wrong. And Hillary mocks Trump over travel ban. Now, the reason this is one day, guys. This is one day. And this is what I want you to think about. Whatever the news that you listen to is, you need to listen to other news. You need to get different variants of point. Because if you're just watching, say, Fox, you're only going to know what Fox wants you to know. If you're watching CNN, you're only going to know what CNN wants you to know. If you want to be a well-rounded individual, how about actually knowing what's going on in the world? And it's not the crap that I just read off of AOL, and I guarantee you on Google or any other the internet sites you go to with your emails, they all have them now, Huffington Post, whatever. They're all the same. I mean, so when you read this, if you didn't actually know what's going on in the world and you read this, Trump is this sucking butt when it comes to being president, and everything's in disarray. But you know the opposite is true. Now, one thing I have to give, I'm starting to like Trump a little bit more. I will admit that openly. I have a lot of reservations about him. But after watching what he's doing, I have to admit, guys, that I'm not going to start wearing the little red hat yet. But he's definitely got my approval so far. Not that that matters to him. But yesterday, or the day before, because me and Cindy aren't feeling good, she stayed home from work, we actually watched some news. And it was on, the only one I really like watching is Varney and Company, which is on Fox Business. Dude's from England, he's an American citizen. He's the only one that seems to actually think for himself and actually look for the truth anymore. So he's really the only one I watch. But in the middle of his broadcast, you could watch his facial expression because they're feeding him information through his ear. And Trump did something that I thought was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant for a president to do. Now, see, the reason I wanted to read you that from AOL, just off the one day on the front page, where it always puts him in a bad slant, Trump is showing strategy unlike any other president that I can even think of in history. The media is completely in false moral outrage on everything he does. So what does Trump do? Does he change the game, or does he continue to stay in the game where they're going to try to cut his legs out from under him? Now, see, most politicians and presidents would do exactly that. They would try to just not, you know, say anything that the media is going to get upset about and be, you know, little wimp bags like we pretty much have in Washington. But Trump, I mean, he's got a set of cojones. When they signed in Jeff Sessions yesterday, they did it on Facebook on a live video feed with no reporters. None of the reporters knew that he was getting ready to get signed in. So therefore, the reporters didn't have anything negative to say ahead of time. And they had to use the footage off of Trump's Facebook page which is going to draw more people to start watching his Facebook page, because if you want to know what's coming out of the government now, you're not getting it anymore from the media that's twisting it and turning it the way they always do. Now they're going to have to be the second in line when it comes to information. I think it is absolute genius for doing what he did yesterday. And the other thing that he did yesterday that really, or the day before, that really got my attention, guys, is you have the same, this limp-wristed, weak, slimy, I don't even know why they're up there, Republicans for the most part. And, you know, they're gonna do the repeal and replace Obamacare, which the replace part is a stupid idea, but they're gonna do it anyway. And then the tax cuts that Trump has been talking about, which, trust me, you want to see America go a little bit crazy with business and people making money, you start letting them keep some of their money, for goodness sake. That's what Trump's smart on this. He understands how that works. So Matt Ryan, you know, the little Eddie Monster dude that runs the Republican Party right now, or the Congress, he says, well, we'll look at this after we do the Obamacare. So he's pushing it way down the road for the tax cuts. So what does Trump do in the middle of a live feed with reporters there? He breaks the news right after Eddie Munster said that. He comes out and says, you will have the tax plan in 2 to 3 weeks. And then right after that, the little blonde girl that's his counselor that's been talking, you know, like kind of a spokesman, she gets on Varney right after that and says the same thing. So even though the Republican Congress that wants to still be the whiny little limp-wristed, you know, get on their knees for any lobbyist prostitutes you can come up with, he's basically just threw them under the bus. Now they're going to have to come up with a tax plan in 2 to 3 weeks. Genius. Everything he's done has been genius. So I've been pretty negative on him, and I just wanted to kind of change that. Now I want to go into something that I was talking to a friend last night, and the subject of silver came up. And the day before, out of the blue, Cindy just told, you know, she just kind of said, you know, gold's going back up in price. And so those two conversations back to back got me thinking, and I want to just throw something at you. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because this is not something that I'm saying you need to do or you should do, but think about the difference this would make in America if Americans actually started thinking in the fashion that I'm getting ready to tell you. And I see, I'm going to use me as an example, and I do have silver, guys. I'm not going to say how much because it's none of your business, but I do have silver for different reasons. And I'm 47. So let's say I'm going to, quote, retire at 65, which I don't see the reason to retire because I've designed my life where that doesn't make sense for me to do that. But let's say I'm going to retire at 65. That gives me 18 years. That's 216 months. Now, in those 18 years, if I was a forward-thinking American instead of a short-sighted American, which is what most Americans are, and I fall in this trap the same as everybody else does on certain things. But let's look at this as a different way that you could change America and absolutely have the most wealthiest individual citizens in the world in a country. And your families generationally would all be wealthy. All be wealthy off a little bit of forward planning. I said we don't do this. We're gonna, you know, we're gonna go to the stock market because it seems easier and all that type stuff. But let's say we change the game a little bit as American citizens. Let's say that you can afford $100 a month, and unless you're in a dire situation where you're about to lose your house or something, you can afford $100 a month. I mean, you're talking what, 10 times not eating fast food, something like that. You know, two tanks of gas, something. You can come up with $100, go deliver a couple of pizzas, whatever. What would that mean if every month we spent $100 and we went and bought silver? That at the end of my 47 to 65, that's 1,080 ounces of silver. And when I'm talking about silver, guys, if you're ever going to look into doing this, buy standard coins, not something that's got any type of unusual, whatever, you know, a little gadget silver type thing. I do have some silver bullets, actually 50 cals, just because I liked them. But you know, when I buy coins, it's going to be something like a Canadian maple leaf, or, you know, the American silver dollar, something like that, where everybody knows what it is. I'm not buying a bunch of oddball stuff or blocks or anything like that. So I can take it anywhere and they know exactly what it is and what it's worth by the spot price. So every month I go buy $100 worth of silver. By the time I'm 65, I have 1,080 ounces of silver. My cost into that silver is going to be $21,600. If I do 200 a month, it'd be $43,200 in silver, which is 2,160 ounces. That's if the prices average about $20, which they seem to do. But if you look at silver, and you're going to be somewhat of a forward-thinking person, is the financial crises we keep finding ourselves in getting shorter in time period or farther apart? Well, they're getting shorter, and they're getting more drastic. And every time one of these corrections happens, what happens to gold and silver? It goes really high. The last time, it was in the mid-60s. You know, I could have been buying silver if I'd have had the forethought for this. Back when it was $5 an ounce, I could have paid off house, bought a new farm. I mean, you know, I'd have been super wealthy if I'd been doing what I've been telling you to do. So, but if when it hits 60, what does my $100 a month turn into? My $21,000 investment now is worth $64,080, and the $200 a month is worth $129,000. So we're going to break this down a little bit different. See, this is a different way of thinking about your own security than most people have ever thought about it in a way. See, I do the same thing with ammo, guns, different products that are assets to completely get them out of the dollar that I can always sell. You know, and that's part of the reason that I have the silver that I have. Gold is the same way. It doesn't matter if you're using gold or silver, they seem to go up. I think most of the time you have a better chance of making more percentage of profit off of silver, but either one of them's fine. I wouldn't get into the crazy, you know, diamonds or anything, because that's subjective, way more than silver and gold is. So, but if you're 22 years old to 65, that's 43 years, that's 516 months. At $100 a month, which is not going to kill you, it's going to be, you're going to have $51,600. At $20 an ounce, you'll have 2,580 ounces of silver. If you do that for $200 a month, you'll have $103,000 saved that's not in the stock market and not at risk or anything like that, that you have a tangible asset that you can sell, and you'll have 5,160 ounces of silver. Now, when it spikes at $60, your $51,000 turns into $154,000, and your $103,000 on the $200 a month turns into $309,600. Now, if you're a man and a wife and you were to do this, you want to talk about not worrying about retirement. You're not going to worry about retirement. But see, there's a way that you've got to understand this. Silver's not what some people call a silver bullet. It's not. It's just an asset, guys. That's all it is. And you can do this with land. You can do anything else. But if a man and a woman were to do this from 22 to 65, you know, when they retired, they'd have over $500,000 in silver. Now, see, you could say, what good is that at that point? Well, let me give you an example. Once you hit 65, because I have friends now that have retired on Social Security, and you go to make money, you're capped or you get severely punished. So you're not going to be able to make a lot of money, and Social Security is not a lot of money. And then you're going to start running through savings and everything else, and you're going to get taxed the death that no one ever seems to think about when they have a 401k, because you're going to lose 40% of it when you take it out. But what do you do with all this silver? Well, let me see. If I'm 65 years old and I'm going to take a little bit of charge of my own retirement, and if we still get Social Security at that time, and me and my wife want to go see, I don't know, run up and see Dunlap up in Alpena, and it's going to cost us about $500. Well, I can take that silver and go trade it in for cash that is not regulated, it is not recorded, and there's no tax consequences for that. So really, that $500, guys, is not $500. It's actually $750 of actual value because I'm not paying taxes on it the way everybody else is going to on their 401k when they do that. So really, it's way more money because you got to take that 40% and add it to the actual value, because one person's going to lose it and one person's going to gain it. And I'd rather be on the gaining side, not just, you know, my thoughts anyway. So if you did that, think about how that would change in retirement. Every month you just take a certain amount of silver down and you sell it at different stores and you walk away with cash, and you've got cash that you need to live on in retirement, and there's not a tax consequence or anything like that. And if there is at that time, there'll be black market, and I'm not afraid of the black market one bit. So, but this is where I want to really get you to think, if Americans would think like this. Now, silver goes up and it goes down. If silver gets high, like now it's about 17 something, if silver gets high, say like over $22, $25 or whatever it is in inflation adjusted dollars at the time, you put the money in cash in that asset and you set it and you wait for it to go back down. Now, like I said, silver is not a silver bullet, guys, so it's not a magical thing. So what you're trying to do is move up in assets all the time. So you buy a bunch of silver, like right now. You just keep buying and buying and buying. When it goes up and spikes, you turn at that point that silver into another asset that's going to be always growing in value for the most part, which is something like land. You know, or it could be, you know, you like fishing. So you go buy at that point, you have enough silver, it jumps up to $65. You take that silver out and you go buy you a river property that you can enjoy with your family. And then when you get older, you can then sell that property for your retirement if you so deem fit, if you don't want to live there and you want to sell your other house. See, we're switching things up. Now, that's the way that I look at silver. When it's low, I buy. If it's high, I put the money back. When it drops back down, I buy. When it peaks, like it did around 2008 and 2009, that's when you go buy other stuff to get it out of silver, unless you're going to use it just for retirement. But now I'm going to blow your mind a little bit on why this is so important if Americans started thinking this way. And if trappers were to do this, we would be the wealthiest families that most of us have ever met in a couple of generations. If you teach your kids to do this, and let's say you have a decent 401k or a pension and you save some money and different things like that, and say you're sitting there, both the married and man and wife have done this, and they're sitting on $600,000. Let's say in retirement they only need $300,000 to supplement the other part. So there sits $300,000 that goes into the child's inheritance. Now, you can't have a snotty-nosed little brat for this to work. You're going to have to actually be a real parent and teach them some financial stability. But then they do the same thing, because they see how important it is, and you've trained them in being smart in doing this. Now, they do that, and then all of a sudden, the family starts building in its assets that aren't legible to the same point of other assets are legible. And then those kids see how much it helped them, and they train their kids in the same way. Now, if my great-granddad was to do this, and then that went to my granddad and my dad and to me, why would I go do something I didn't want to do if I know I'm sitting on assets probably of a couple of $1 million that are continually growing that I'm going to give down the road to other family members? Now, what do you think that would mean to the freedom of the people that did something like this? Now, I say I'm being silent right now because I want you to think about that a minute. If you trained your children and you did the same thing, you would completely change the dynamic of your family forever. You could put it in trust if you were worried you had a snotty-nosed brat that he couldn't touch it until he was 65 or something like that. But just think about what that would mean for families. That means when we're coming to trapping conventions, or, you know, now if we have been doing this for a while, we would all be millionaires. All of us would be millionaires. We wouldn't hear all of the, I hate going to work Monday morning, it sucks, this, that, and the other, got to work because of insurance and all that. all be different. So think about this or other things like this if you want to get out of the 40-hour work week and being stressed all the time on money. Sometimes it is in your hands and it can be done very easily if you just put your brain to work instead of your back sometimes. Just my thoughts on that anyway. So I don't know why I just felt like I needed to say that, but it's something that's pretty it's pretty neat. I've got buddies that have a gun collection. They buy a gun every other month. They do this. They buy the best. They buy name brands. They buy the best finishes, the best everything on the pistols. They never shoot them. They put them in a box. And when they're in retirement age, you know what they're going to be doing? They're going to be selling a pistol or two every month or so when they need money, and it's completely off the books. So what they're doing is they're insulating themselves against any craziness in the dollar. Because no matter what happens in America, silver, guns, ammo, different things like that are always going to be a value. Always, no matter what the dollar does. So just a little bit of thinking about that. Now we're going to go into, this is kind of hard to read the way this email was done, but it's I think it's a great question. Now this is a secondary part of the first one. So I'm going to read the first one. I'm going to try to, my computer's messing up, but it says, Mr. Clint, sorry for asking such a simple question, but I just want to verify. When I catch on a drag, I replace the trap, correct? Question mark. I'm just getting into drags, and I'm so confused by all the information in quotes in print. I know I would normally keep the same trap at the same catch circle, but each time I catch with a drag, would I replace the trap? Thank you. I've already answered this email, but this is I kind of get this stuff all the time, and I've talked about scent control and different things like that. And basically what I told him is, dude, don't worry about it. Go put it back in the ground. Put it to work. And I think I know what he was getting at is you catch an animal in the trap. You're on a drag. You're not in the catch circle, so you don't have all that odor right there, which a drag is very good for. And then all of a sudden, you're going to take that trap that smells like the animal and put it back in there, and it could cause you issues. And that comes from the wannabe, coyote trappers that think you got to walk around with an oxygen tank and a body condom and everything else. And, you can't even let fresh air touch your traps before you go put them in the ground and all that type stuff. And over the years, this has caused a lot of confusion. Now, most of y'all have seen a lot of my videos and the pictures and stuff. Guys, I'm probably the worst offender of having traps that need to be cleaned, and I still keep them working. So obviously, that is not the issue that people make it out to be. So if you're thinking about along the same lines as this, guys, that you need to have a clean trap because you moved the trap and you're going back, dude, you're doing too much work. Just put the trap back in the ground and let it do what it was designed to do, and that's catch an animal. It doesn't have to be sterile by any stretch of the imagination when it comes to that. So I wanted to, that was the first question. Now this other one's a much bigger one, and it's kind of funny to me. But I understand the frustration from this. So this, JP, you know who you are. Sounds good. I have another question for you. How many coyotes are in a family group? I've asked this on Trapping Man, was so confused after I asked, basically stop asking questions on the site. I was told a pack about 10, there would be no packs of coyotes dispersed like foxes do in October, to an alpha female, 3 pups and a dad. Anyway, I literally realized there was no point in trying to actually learn anything of any value, and just don't ask questions on there unless it's what the best trap is, or what the best bait is, or how far do you offset a coyote trap, or what's this track. And then I was told by someone, I ask a lot of questions, and for me to get with an experienced trapper, which is good advice, they never set well with me because that gentleman does not know me from Adam's ass. I could be a mega superstar or a beginner, but really I'm somewhere in between, probably closer to the beginning sides of the spectrum. I've been very confused on predators this year than previous years. My second year coyote trapping, didn't catch any, uh, my the second year of coyote trapping. I didn't catch any of the first year, no surprise. I caught 18 coyotes, very few fox or bobcats. Moved to Memphis last year and didn't do well on predator trapping, just a few small beaver lines. This year, I wised up and moved out of the cesspool back to the country. Good job. Well, I'll be whooping up on the fox and cats, but other than a couple of fence-snared coyotes and catching them on some trash mounds, it's been a discouraging mess. What I'm starting to think, because usually I'm actually trying for coyotes, but I've been getting back foot catches a lot on cats and fox. I'm thinking my trap is too far from my flat set. I'm thinking the grays are so noisy and like to rub on my coyote glands. Nosy. Their back feet on the pan. Same with coyotes. Well, maybe some, I think, are turning and walking away. So to conclude this lengthy email, how many coyotes could I expect to tell a person that I am coyote trapping for? You know, on their land here in the southeast, and how many in a beaver colony, as well as I'm thinking 7 to 10. How many I can actually catch before I think they're all gone? And if I'm back foot catching large portion of animals, should I move the trap closer? I do like catching, so it's been hard to adjust. That's why I'm having a hard time trying to unlearn everything that is wrong. I told you I caught 18 coyotes first year. I actually started catching, and in my mind, I think it got me used to doing the wrong thing by trapping a population of untouched, for sure not educated coyotes, and got me thinking some things were okay when they actually weren't. I do remember I used to put my dog in my trap right up to the lip of the hole for the dirt hole in exactly 10 inches. See, let me get that right. You're putting your dog up towards the hole in exactly 10 inches and levers pointed directly. You're talking about a different set, and your flat sets are 10 inches away from your flat set. As I finished the Eastern Wolfer book, about 40 pages into Mr. Craig's book, the coyote bobble hoof beats, which it is, I'm so dang topsy-turvy and confused as to how I ever caught the one in the first place. Anyway, I'm just trying to catch coyotes because I did end up learning I was missing way more coyotes than I was catching. Guys, the email's not hard to read. The way it's just showing up on the computer, it's like in one great big long line, so I'm trying to catch up with it. I was catching by dog being, okay, I was catching by the dog being tight to the hole, but it's always a learning process. I'm just trying to ask someone, not just anyone, because I see where that got me. That actually knows how to catch these dogs and not be an internet warrior living vicariously through Trapper and Predator Caller or Trapper's World. Thank you for your time, Mr. Clint. Okay. I'm sure by the way I read that, that's going to be hard to go. But JP, for one, all the little tiny measurements and all the little stuff that people think is important for the most part are not. And if you're catching stuff and it's by the back feet, I'm not sure I would change anything, to be honest with you. You're catching. You know, if you're catching cats and fox by the back feet and your trap's further back at 10 inches, which I don't think's too far at all, I wouldn't change anything. You may want to play around just for, and it's the learning process of maybe playing around with some in the front, some on the side, you know, on a 45, some more to the side, and kind of see. Because what you're going to find out is the way that animals approach certain sets, depending on what you're doing, and it's almost impossible to talk in audio this way. But certain sets, they get a lot closer on a straight-on angle, and certain sets, and a lot of it depends on how they're going to work the set from the travel way, is they're going to just like do a little drive-by, and they're not going to have to move their feet very much to be over towards the trap, so the trap should be more on the side. So a basic rule with flat sets, especially, the closer to the travel way that it is, and it's a real flat set with hardly any eye appeal, if it's right on the road, I want to have the trap like if the road was a creek and the water's going up or down, you know, with the current, I want it where it's going to be up or down with the current. So if you've got a grass clump and you're going to put some lure bait on that, and you're not going to be digging a hole or anything that's visual, if the grass clump is right on the edge of the road, the trap should also be right on the edge of the road, in my opinion, up or down from it. So because the coyote, if you think about a coyote, draw it on a piece of paper, put your little grass clump, draw your road. If a coyote's coming down the edge of the road, he's just going to stay on that little bit of angle, and that's where his feet's going to be. If it's 2 foot off the road, then the trap's going to start swinging a little bit more towards the road, because the coyote, when he comes over to just smell it, he's going to have to come over more at a front way, you know, but not all the way at a front way, because he's only got to go 2 feet. So what I'm saying is the coyote's not going to go to the direct front of the flat set, do a military right-hand turn or a left-hand turn to go into the set. So you're going to want to just try to account for the swing over on flat sets. If it's farther back, say 4 or 5 feet, now the trap starts getting more into the center of the what you would call the front of the set. See, the coyote don't know what the front of the set is. It's just smelling something and going over there to kind of see what's going on. So the farther you get off of that, the further the trap gets in front. Now, since you're reading Craig's book, Hoofbeats of a Woofer, which is probably the Bible of coyotes and trapping, you will notice on his sets, he does not set close to the road. This is what I learned when I went and took an instruction from him. He comes from the era of everybody steals from everybody back in the fur boom. So they never set right on a trail or a two-track. He would always be 10 or 12 feet off from the two-track, on the where the wind blows from his trap to the travel way. So when you see him always having pretty much his trap directly in front of his flat sets, it's not the set, it's how far he is off of the travel way from that. So I hope that makes sense. So the closer, you know, it is, the less swing out. The less swing out you're going to get. So like if I'm setting a grass clump, you draw this on a sheet of paper, you got your grass clump, I want you to come straight down the page and go over to the road like 2 inches. So you come down 10 or 12 inches and go over two, straight down the road, not in front of the set where you're kneeling to make the set, but going down, go down about 10 or 12 inches, go over two. You'll see how almost in line that is with the front of your set, but it's on a downstream side kind of the way of looking at it. So when you're looking at Craig's set, all of his sets are off of the travel way, and that's the reason his are swung into the front, because they're going to smell that from the travel way and then go to it, and they've got to do a right-hand turn or something very similar to that to get to his set. But most trappers don't set like that in the east. Not there's anything wrong with what he's doing, but it's just the way that he does it. And it gets confusing in his book, especially if you've never seen him do that, because when he's showing locations, it doesn't come across the same way in the book. So, you know, don't get so caught up. Now, how many coyotes are in a family group? Well, I mean, it's a time thing. It really is. It's if we start in breeding season, which in Memphis is probably going to be probably late February, middle February to March, somewhere in there, could go into April. The only coyotes that are pretty much going to be there are the mom and dad, the alpha male and the alpha female. They got a territory, and then they're going to have pups. Now, the pups can be anywhere from 2 to as high as 12 or 14, but probably around 6 to 8 is what they're going to have. So when you go, you know, into the late spring, early summer type area, the family group is going to go from 10 to 2 to could be somewhere 4 to 10. You mean you just really don't know. There's not a number per se. It depends on how much water they have, how much food they have, different things like that is dependent on really how many, the more food, the more babies are going to have. That's just kind of the way nature works. And that number is going to stay pretty consistent up until probably about October, November for you on your parallel, which is about the same as mine, before you really start seeing the dispersal. And then those family groups don't make any sense anymore at that point because the coyotes are going everywhere. Mom and dad go everywhere. The kids go everywhere. It's just a great big school's out for the summer type thing. They're running all over the place. So how many's on a piece of property at that time? There is no way to know. And that's just an honest answer. Anybody says they do is making it up. And then that'll go on until they start breeding season again. So the time of your year has a lot to do with how many coyotes you've got on a piece of property. So if you go in, say, in June, you're probably going to be dealing with very small pups and a couple adults. And that's it. So, and their family group is going to be in a tight circle. They're only going to go as far as they have to go to feed themselves and feed the pups. That's as far as they're going to go. And that leaves a lot of dead area where there's really not any coyotes to speak of except around these, you know, these den areas. And sometimes they only go at the most maybe a quarter, half a mile if they've got the food source around them to keep them fed. So, you know, it's one of those, we as a trapper, we want to know, you know, how many coyotes are there, but that we really don't know. And that's just an honest answer. And it really does change with the time of the year of what that is. So, I mean, you can adjust of what that is. So if you're doing control work, which it may sound like you're leaning towards, by the way, that question was answered or asked, it's going to really depend on when it is. And the best time to do it, unfortunately, is when the fur is not any good, is going to be once they have pups, and then you find out where they're you start finding droppings, and then that's where you start setting. But you don't really go try to get too far into their circle because they'll bounce, which just means the mom will literally take the pups and leave. And then there's nothing there at that point because coyotes aren't going into other coyotes' territory at this time. That's just not their social order of how they're doing that. Now, with beaver, dude, that's just an educated guess based off of what you see. Now, if you go into someone's pond or swamp or something like that, and you see just a few cuttings, and the dam looks like it's, you know, not really looked at very often and stuff like that, you're probably only dealing with one to two adults. That's it. Now, if they have kids with them, now you're going to have cuttings all over the place, and you're going to have a lot more beaver to catch. So it's kind of based off sign, and it's mostly based off the chewing and stuff like that, because, you know, the beaver that are there to 1 to 2 years, they're being teenagers and they're being rambunctious and they're out just doing their thing, and they leave a lot of sign. Well, the old adults that don't really have kids to worry about, they just kind of do enough what they need to do, and they kind of live a lazy, boring life, and they don't leave a lot of sign. So that's pretty much how I kind of judge of what it is. And, you know, you also got to think about where you're at, and being in Memphis, you know, you're going to have a lot higher beaver densities than, say, someone in Pennsylvania. Someone from Pennsylvania comes down to Memphis, or New York, for an example, comes down to Memphis. When they go in to trap a beaver flow or a pond, you know, they're usually looking at, you know, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5, where you go into a swamp that's, you know, a couple acres in size, and there could be 3, 4 different houses in there, and you look around and you see these houses got the fresh mud on all. I've been in those places where you can take 30 beaver out of 2 acres. You know, I mean, so those numbers are very different from where you're at. So the only reason I'm saying that, guys, so if you're not in the South, on the, you know, in the Delta, and you're thinking that you're going to go somewhere in New York and consistently catch that many beavers in that small area, you're probably not going to, you know. And you also have to think, is it moving water or slack water that you're dealing with? If it's moving water, you got beaver that travel up and down that actually do cross territories. And especially when you find those territories that meet, that's where you find those places that's got all these, it looks like this Castor Mound heaven. And in that particular area, you're going to have whatever the number of beaver are that are on both sides of it. I've been in a few places where I think there was three beaver colonies that come together in a swamp, and I bet there was 50 or 60 castor mounds, and every day I would set traps. You know, I'm catching 4 to 5 all within probably as big as a 600 square foot house, because that's where they're all defending their territory, and that's where they come, and whatever you caught was chewed up from what you didn't catch. So I mean, there's a lot that goes on when you're trying to figure out what the numbers of stuff is, you know what it is. But so that's one of the first things. Now, as far as where you put your trap, I would put it where your gut tells you to. And sometimes you have to learn to turn off the systematic way that we think now in America, you know, where it's formulaic, it's everything's based on production and machinery the way that it is now. So, you know, you have a hole that's 3 inches, you know, round, it's 12 inches deep, you come 12 inches back, and then you go 4 inches to the right, for example, and that's where your trap goes, and you put your drop in just right here, then you put your lure just right. See, that's the way we think now, because we came, you know, where our education comes from the industrial age, and we think like that. But that's not the way nature works. My advice to you is, when you put a set in, just take a second and go, if I was a coyote, how would I approach this set? From the travel way, or from it's on a little knoll, or whatever, what's the vegetation like? You know, figure that out. Like, I know that you've got a lot of vegetation in Memphis. Well, if I'm putting in a dirt hole, one of the things that I do is I put the dirt hole in with the vegetation that kind of guides the coyote to come in a certain angle. So if I've got a choice of a cut field to go put a set in, or I've got one that's really rough and you got the clumps of buffalo grass and everything, I'm going to use those to like pick two of those buffalo grasses, put my dirt hole where it's in between, and have the trap in between the buffalo grass, because that's how the coyote's going to go through there, which is completely against a formulaic way of setting. And I think you'll be a happier trapper with your results, maybe not at first, but if you start thinking about how would a coyote actually work this set. Now, keep in mind, they're a little phobic, they're skittish, you know, all that stuff needs to come into play. They're not going to walk up to it like a house dog eating its alpo bowl, which I hear trappers give an example all the time where the feet are. That's a totally different animal in a very comfortable setting. A coyote in the wild with something strange is not going to be that way. But if you kind of just think of it and go, you know, the trail's pretty close, and I can use this grass clump, or, you know, this root, or, you know, side of a tree to kind of guide him to one direction, so he's probably going to come more over here. It takes all of that formulaic way out of thinking, and now you're starting to trap an animal instead of trap a formula. That's what to me gets people frustrated, is you're trying to force a set which is not natural, and it's not in even a natural way of thinking. It's in a human way of thinking. You're trying to force that on that animal, and it goes sideways most of the time, because the animal doesn't think the way that we do. He's just going up to check something out. So in thinking that there is just a way that all coyotes work a set, so it needs to be a certain way, guys, to me, that is absolute ignorance of wildlife and individual animals to think that way. And if you do, I'm not calling you ignorant. I'm just saying that to me, that process of thinking is ignorant. And I'm doing that saying that in a way that's not insulting, but it's just, you know, I don't know how to build a nuclear bomb, so I'm ignorant in that. You know, it's not that I'm a stupid person, I just don't know. But if you're going off a formulaic way all the time, and you're not thinking about how the coyote's going to actually move, you're gonna be screwed up. Now, if you think and you see in your area the coyotes are getting really, really close to the hole, then move your trap up. And when you start doing kind of what I'm trying to get you to think about, where you're thinking about the animal instead of formulaic way, you're going to have misses because you're not a coyote or a fox or a cat. You know, you're going to have misses, but that's okay. If you learn from those, especially if you do them, and if you do really big, like since you're reading the Wolfer book, I would start with the Charlie Robbins dirt hole set, which if you don't know what that is, you can go look at, I've got videos of it on my YouTube, and that's what Randy Smith uses. It's a great big dirt hole that's on an angle, and it's got a humongous trap pattern. I mean, it's like 18 inches wide, a couple, 3 feet back, just torn up ground. Put your trap where you think it should be, and then watch the tracks. But don't just watch the tracks. Think about that set of where it is and where you put it to where the coyotes are coming into it. And you'll start getting this feeling about what's going to happen. Now, if you've got this great big old blown up dirt pattern where it looks like a big badger or groundhog's done it, and they're digging at your hole, but they're not getting onto your pattern, see, that's where you go, ding, ding, ding. Maybe I should move my trap off of the dirt pattern and blend it into the side they're digging on the hole. See, then you can start figuring that out, because it gets, you know, what, like someone watches me cat trap, or, you know, it's one thing all the time. When they watch me coyote trap, it's like I'm a schizophrenic, you know, person. Because none of them are the same. The trap placement could be 6 inches, it could be 14, it could be 3 feet, it could be to the back of the hole, the side of the hole, it could be in front of it, it could be anywhere, but I'm just trying to mentally judge where that's going to be. And if you do that, then you're not relying on what someone else is telling you to do. Like, one thing I would really advise you to do, or anybody else that wants to really get into serious coyote trapping, Craig O'Gorman's got a video, and his videos are expensive. They're VHS, so if you don't have a VHS player, I don't know what you're going to do with it. But if you still have one that works, or has a friend that has a VH player, he's got one that he calls like tips and tricks for educated coyotes or something like that. You'll recognize it kind of what I'm telling you. It's one of his newer videos, even though it's still old, and he does a lot of decoy sets. And once you see that and you really think about it, because it's going to frustrate you if you want a formulaic set, then you'll start kind of seeing the way that he sees a coyote coming to the set and working the set. And then you can start adjusting off of that, you know. So, but I wouldn't get too upset about if your catch kind of wanes at first when you're doing this, because it's kind of like the silver I was talking about. You pay the price at the beginning and you're set after that. But if you do the formulaic way of setting, you're restricted to the formulaic way of setting. So as you're learning this and you get better at it, your catch is going to increase very rapidly, because you're going to start seeing patterns, and that's what you're looking for as a trapper, is patterns. You know, if it's really close to the woods, are they coming in from the woodside, even though there's an open field out here, which you'll find out they probably are, you know, different things like that. If it's out in the open, is there a way that you can see the tracks on muddy ground and stuff like that, that they're circling 3 or 4 foot out? That should be a light bulb going out. Well, maybe I can use the big blown up dirt hole set as a decoy. I can or cannot put a trap in it. Then I can go 2 or 3 foot back and just put a little bit of gland lure or something like that on a very small grass clump on the side that their tracks are on, and then really blend in a set. So you'll start seeing patterns like that, and you'll start nailing coyotes, not even at your set now. You're catching them off of your set being a decoy to catch them, if that makes any sense. So don't really be worried about that. And as far as how far back in front, if you're catching fox and cows by the back foot, dude, you're catching cats and fox. Don't get wrapped up. It has to be front foot. It doesn't make any difference whatsoever of which one you're catching them in. You know, people think that they're right-handed or left-handed, or you want to catch them in the front foot because of this. Just catch the freaking animal. I mean, that's really what it is that you need to be doing. And if you start playing around with your trap placement, what you think the animals are going to do, it'll probably start leveling out. I still catch animals by the back foot, and a lot of my coyote sets, the trap's 12, 14 inches back. Now, a lot of times, they're up working the set, and their back feet are moving around, and they eventually get closer to the hole, and you catch them. Now, as far as them walking away, I seriously doubt that's what's going on. Because most animals, when you watch the tracks, they go up to the set and continue on that way. See, that's a pattern you'll see once you get out of the formulaic way of thinking. So they're really not turning around unless it's in a situation that they have to turn around, like my bobcat sets that you can, that you can see. When a cat gets in that chute the way it is, he's got to come back out that way. I mean, unless he's going to jump 2 or 3 feet up in the air or climb the tree or do something. You know, but most animals, if it's especially like a coyote set where you're not blocking them in that way, just they're going to keep going on. So I don't think they're backing up. Don't worry about, think about it this way. Trapping is a lot like sex. It's never really any good till it's a little bit ugly. And that's what you need to do when you're coyote trapping. It needs to be perfect or it needs to be a little bit ugly. And perfect is in blending sets, and ugly is on dirt pattern sets. So just keep that in mind. No one wants to have a sexual partner where it's just the same thing all the time. Neither do they want to have it where it's sterile. You know, so when you're going out, have fun. Try to think like a coyote. You're not going to think like a coyote at the beginning. But once you get that down, it opens up a whole new world of trapping that you're going to be so much more efficient than worrying about exactly 6 inches or 10 inches or 12 inches for the trap placement. Because really, when you start trapping animals, all that goes out the way when you quit doing the formulaic type of way. So, man, I hope that helps you out, JP. Congratulations on getting back out to the country. Memphis is not a place that I'd want to live in, I can tell you that. So, we're going to go to one that, like I said, guys, this is going to be schizophrenic. Let's see here. Food foraging. To me, this lit my day up. I've been watching some of you folks' videos while I had some downtime. Meat foraging really seemed like a concept. So I'm setting goal for myself. Since I live on the Gulf Coast, I decided to break out my nets, crab traps, and fishing gear to provide all of my seafood needs for my family for a year, not to purchase any from the store. Plus, I get to spend quality time off the tug with my 2 young sons and God's creation, harvesting his bounty. Win-win, I think. Thanks for your inspiration. Michael T., dude, you're going to love it. You know, and one thing, depending on where you're at on the Gulf Coast, get creative with it. You'll be surprised as far as, you know, the shrimp, oysters, clams, different things like that. Don't forget about the land side as far as the deer. I know your deer you can put in your front pocket down there. But, you know, if you can get several of them, you can really help fill up a freezer. A lot of the Gulf Coast has a lot of hog problems. You won't find any problem where you can go kill some hogs. Wild hogs are awesome. And if you build that up, guy, you're going to have a blast. Not just from the health reasons from eating that type of way. You're going to be healthier because you're going out to do it. And you're mentally going to be such a more centered person when you do stuff like this. So really, really cool what you're doing with that, I think. Okay, I'm going to go to the next one. Let's see. Bobcat Dispatch. Now, this is one, guys, that I'm going to refer you to my YouTube channel so you can see this, but I'm going to quickly go through this. I recently purchased 3 live bobcat traps. After reviewing Clint's DVD, he mentioned no need to shoot a cat. That's right, because you shoot a cat, it's a sin, and you go to hell for that sin, so don't shoot the cat. But use a catch pole to eliminate the blood issue. How do I accomplish this when using live cages? Is there a video to show a proper procedure? Yeah, if you go back in my YouTube, you just have to search through them. you'll see down in Texas, we have a guy that's never trapped doing it, and he gets smacked in the face. It's kind of funny in a weird way, but you'll see what it is. So basically, you have a cat in a cage. It's laying on the ground the way that you set the cage. Now, depending on the type of door you have, is how you're going to have to work the door. And our cat cages have the guillotine door, and it's got a lock on it. So what we do is you walk up to the cat, and you can take a pair of pliers or whatever if you think the cat's getting too spunky with you, and you set it up on its end. So the back end of the cage, it's not your door, you raise the cage up on its end. Now you're looking at the door, and what the cat will do is he will go to the bottom of that, and he'll be staring at you. So then you have to pop open the door. Now every now and then a cat will try to blow out, so you have to be ready if that happens to slam the door back to do that. Most of the time, probably 95% of the time, the cat's going to sit in the bottom and growl at you. And he's going to be looking at you, which is what you want him to do. If he's not looking at you, you have to get his attention. Tell him how pretty his coat is, about how good the weather is, about who won the Super Bowl, whatever. Get his attention. You want him to, if you've got anybody else with you, they need to quit moving, quit talking, doing everything else. The one with a catch pole that's at the cage is the only guy that's allowed to make any noise or move. You want the cat to lock eyes with you. Physically lock eyes. And when he locks eyes with you, you don't turn away either. You lock eyes back with that cat. Now, you just did something to that cat that he is not going to be very uncomfortable with because you're doing eye-to-eye contact with him. And if you're talking with him, and you got eye-to-eye contact with him, he's going to be in flight or fight mode. And most of the time, it's going to be in flight mode, which he just wants to get away. And he's waiting for an opportunity. So what you're going to do is you're going to barely open that door just enough with your catch pole to slide down between the cage and the door with a loop already open big enough to go around his head. That's when you really start telling him how pretty he is and, you know, he's going to have a nice trip to Canada or whatever you're going to tell him. But you need to talk in a very calm way. Just start talking to him, but you keep eye-to-eye contact with him. Until you do what I'm getting ready to tell you to do, you're going to think I'm crazy, but it's pretty simple once you see it. When you're talking to that cat and you've got eye-to-eye contact, even though the catch pole is in the cage with it, he may swat at it a few times, just keep talking to him, get him locked back on you, and you can just slowly move that loop over its neck. Most of the time, it's very uneventful. Once you get it around his neck, you jerk the catch pole, and then it doesn't matter if he comes out of the cage or not, because he's on the end of your pole. Now, what you need to be aware of, which you'll see in that video on YouTube, is you need to have control of the pole because that pole smacked this dude in the mouth and he ended up bleeding a little bit. So you got to have control because when you do tighten the catch pole, it goes from flight mode to pure fight mode. And there's going to be about a 40-second explosion of muscle, teeth, and claws going every which direction. So you've got to have control of that. But it's really simple. If you stay calm, you talk to the cat, you get eye contact, you slowly put the pole in. If he's going to slap it or bite at it a few times, you just keep it in there. You keep talking to him, you'll get it around his neck. No quick movements, just do it real slow. Close it around his neck, and then you'll have this procedure completely done. So I hope that helps you out, Steve, because it is something until you do it, it doesn't seem like it's going to work. Okay, go to the next one. This is one I found was interesting. Today I received your Bobcat Trapping DVD. I've only watched DVD number one so far, but I noticed Clint using Bobcat urine on each of his sets, but your website does not sell urine. Am I missing something? This is a different Steve. No, you're not missing anything. When I do a Bobcat set, I want a good lure, like Cat Collector, and I want the body odor of a cat. And I don't particularly care if it's good urine, cat urine, or it's cat droppings that are fresh, or it's my booty call bobcat gland. I don't really care which one it is. Now, when I'm trapping around here and I'm running more mixed lines, I use booty call gland lure. When I'm in Texas and we're running, you know, 175 traps and you're catching stuff all the time, the amount of gland lure to do it on that scale is out of control. It really is. It's just out of control at that time. So I don't go the gland route because I'm running so many sets and we're catching so much stuff that it would just be, it'd be gallons of cat gland. And that's doesn't make a lot of sense. But with the urine, if I start running short down in Texas, I can pick up the phone and call F&T or Jeb out of Okie Cable and Trap, and it'll be there in 2 days. So when I'm running really high numbers of bobcat sets with traps, I go to urine because it's inconvenient to have that much gland lure. So if you were to listen to what I said and went down and did a line like I was doing, you would go through so much bobcat gland that it would almost become, it would really hurt you on your expense part. So, you know, that's the reason. The urine's a little bit cheaper. It's easier to use, and it's just more convenient when I'm going at it at that scale. And I, like I said, I really don't care what someone uses as long as they have the body odor of a cat in there. It could be as simple as putting a carpet in someone's kitty litter box and just letting it soak it up and throw it and cutting the carpet up in little bitty cubes and using that. It doesn't matter. It's a body odor of a cat. It doesn't matter what it is. Now, I've done that, and it works fine. That is nasty. I mean, that is nasty. And you may think you'll do it to save a little bit of money, but I doubt you'll do it very often because it is nasty. But it does work. Really fresh cat droppings, and I mean fresh, that's fine to use that too. Just the body odor of a cat, however you want to do it. And the other reason you don't see bobcat urine on my website is I don't sell anything that I don't make and control the quality of. So I'm not buying anything like urine or any, I don't sell anything that I don't have 100% control over the quality of it. And since I don't have bobcats in cages for urine, I don't sell it. And that's just a business, that's my business model, you know, because when I send something out, I want it to be exactly what it's supposed to be and not different grades of what it's supposed to be. And I can't do that with urine. You know, there's no way I could do that with urine. So that's one of the main reasons I don't sell it. But that's still a good question. Okay. Let's see how much time we got. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're going to go ahead and finish up. Now, I do have some news. I've got a spy that's going to be doing an unofficial fur bearing report from the real world, hopefully coming up soon. I talked to him before we got on the show. He's kind of the guy that kind of has his fingers in a lot of different places, and he knows a lot of people, and he knows who to listen to and who not to listen to. Plus, he goes to a lot of auctions and talks to people. So he's going to be probably doing a report coming up on the fur prices. Now, what's interesting about the fur prices is NAFA's is in the middle of having a sale as we speak. They're doing coyotes, pine marten, and bobcats, and maybe fisher or something. I'm not sure, but the bobcats and the pine marten haven't been run through. The coyotes have, and the prices are looking a lot better than anybody thought they would be for the westerns, the heavies, and the easterns. Now, what that means as far as southern, I have no idea. But the prices are definitely going up. The other thing that's interesting about the fur market right now is muskrats seem to be, when you talk to people that are going to auctions, are averaging about $5 a piece, which is very different than we thought when we started this season. That's a lot higher than anybody was thinking. And at some of the auctions, they're running $7 a piece. Now, I've heard all kind of people thinking what they should average at NAFA, and I don't know, so I'm not going to say, but it seems like we're kind of on the upswing of the downside that we've been on in the fur market, which is awesome news. So once our super duper unofficial fur spy starts giving us a report, he's going to be doing it from the ground level, not from the marketing level that a lot of the stuff that you hear about comes from. Because he's not a fur buyer and he's not an auction house. So what it is just what it is. So keep that in mind. And the song this week, guys, if you're young, you're not going to have any idea who this is. But for you older guys that are my age or a little bit younger, or even older, you're probably going to know exactly who this is. And I heard this the other day. And I was actually driving by myself and I got tickled. Because who you're going to hear is the queen of rock and roll. And I don't think anybody can dispute that. Now, younger guys, you're going to have to go look up who this is. If you don't know who Joan Jett is, you're going to have to go look her up. She's definitely not Taylor Swift or some fabricated singer that seems to be popular now. This was when real rock and roll was Smash Mouth, in your face, and just having fun. And what got me tickled about this song is I remember when this was on the air and she was singing this song and all of us guys would kind of like be shaking our heads up and down going, yeah. So I thought we would dedicate the song to the queen of rock and roll.